Well, good morning and welcome to chapel. Welcome to day two of our Human Sexuality Symposium. Thanks to about 250 of you all who came out last night to be a part of our sex panels. If you didn't get your questions answered, Greg will be available after chapel, so you can direct them all to him. He's ready and waiting. But thanks so much, and thanks to our panelists for being a part of that. It was a Holy Spirit moment for us in the women's panel, and I've heard great things about the men as well. So thanks for participating and joining into the conversation. Tonight at 9 o'clock, we have Word in Reasoner 2:14. So come out and take some time to spend in the Word with one another. And then tomorrow night at 9 o'clock, we'll have our relationship panels. So that will be co-ed. So we'll all be in the Stoosh tomorrow at 9 o'clock and come prepared to hear how God works in our relationships with one another. Thank you.
Our backdrop every morning reminds us and invites us into our theme to become. As children of God, we know that when Christ appears, we will be like him. And so this is day number three of Human Sexuality Symposium, and there's a lot more people that can answer your questions than just me, which is a good thing. As we commit this week to conversation around becoming, it's the question of how is Christ at work forming our sexuality, forming your sexuality. And Monday began the week with Helen Music, and we heard that reminder of God's deep, unconditional love for us. And that unconditional love is a love that is present this week as we converse, and it's present to confirm what he has called us toward, and it's present to restore us to himself from those places and the ways in which we've diverted from what he's called us toward. It's a great thrill to introduce Dr. Chris Kieslin this morning. He'll bring a unique perspective to us through the teaching of pair bonding. And Chris and I share a great deal in common. We grew up in the same theological tradition. We attended the same college, Texas Tech University. Guns up. We're shaped by the same college ministry, the Wesley Foundation. We both received an MDiv from Asbury Seminary, and we share the same grandparents. So I get to call Chris Cuz. And that is a big deal for me. He is one of three cousins in my life. Since he's 3 years my senior, he unknowingly had significant influence on my faith, on my campus ministry experience, and where God was calling me for seminary. I could tell you many stories about a Sharon Holliday, stories about kicking through closet doors, or a story about a Christmas Day motorcycle wreck, but those will have to wait. Chris is professor of human development and Christian discipleship at Asbury Seminary. He spent time investing in youth ministry during his college years. After attending Asbury Seminary, he served in college ministry and pastored a church in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. He served 5 years as an associate pastor in Lubbock, Texas, and received his PhD from Texas Tech University. He gives significant thought and study around the development of collegians and young adults, which some of you have experienced in class through the book that he co-authored, Spiritual Formation in Emerging Adulthood, A Practical Theology for College and Young Adult Ministry. Chris and his wife, Suzanne, have two stellar young men as their children. Daniel is working on an MBA in Florida, and their son Samuel is a senior in high school, and you can pray for him to be an Asburyan. As you engage the topic this morning, you'll have the opportunity to ask Chris more questions over lunch. We'll do a lunch talk back in the gray room in the back corner of the cafeteria. Bring your trays in there. We'll be there from 11:30 to 1 p.m. today. And let's welcome Dr. Chris Kieslin to Asbury.
Well, my gratitude to Cousin Greg and his team for the kind invitation to be here. It's a long ways from the dirt roads of Lockett, Texas, where we would chase jackrabbits on motorbikes to looking after the spiritual lives of Asburyans. But every time I think of it, I give thanks for Greg and for the opportunity that God has brought to him here. I want to begin with a quote from Frederick Buechner, the noted author who wrote, "Our society is filled with people for whom the sexual relationship is one where body meets body, but where person fails to meet person, where the immediate need for sexual gratification is satisfied, but where the deeper need for companionship and understanding is left untouched. The result is that the relationship leads not to fulfillment, but to a half-conscious sense of incompleteness, of inner loneliness, which is so much the sickness of our time. The desire to know another person's nakedness is really the desire to know and to be known, not just sexually, but as a total human being. It's a desire for a relationship where each gives not just of one's own body, but of one's own self, body and spirit both, for the other person's gladness." My aim this morning is to provide for you a roadmap, a tool for sexual decision making, what human developments call a conceptual itinerary that can help you avoid what Buechner is calling inner loneliness, the sickness of our time, and instead provide what the scriptures intend as a one flesh union. Now, in order to fully present that, I'll have to trust that the foundational biblical and theological frameworks have already been provided as part of this week. I wanted to simply ask that it will suffice to see if I can offer a single biblical passage. This familiar one from the book of Genesis. "For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother, he shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Creation intent. It's echoed by Jesus when he's asked a question about a divorce, and he sends the hearers back to this Genesis account, the original creation intent. It's also echoed in Paul's letter to the Ephesians. So we're going to focus on one flesh union. Now I'm going to go in an interesting direction because I want to evoke a theory that comes from an interesting source, a British zoologist by the name of Desmond Morris, who wrote a book called Intimate Behavior. And Morris was so keen on observing animal behavior that he became a great observer of human behavior as well. And he laid out what's usually he calls a complex sequence of gradually increasing intimacies. And what I want to put before us today is to offer this because I think what Morris has provided for us is a description of a sequence of physical intimacies that have connected to it emotional and spiritual intimacies that can help us evaluate and move toward an effective pair bond. What Morris essentially says is that when these sequence of pair bonding stages are followed, it increases a sense of trust and it leads to a healthy pair bond. When they're neglected or rushed through, they create almost inevitably a defective pair bond where trust is diminished and where we end in the place that Buechner calls the sickness of our time. Now, in order to help you understand Morris, I need to give you one or two concepts. Morris is keen on talking about thresholds. Thresholds, I think, are interesting because thresholds usually elicit one of two ideas. One is the stimulation of a nerve that begins to create a physiological response. That is, that when you reach a particular threshold in your body, nerve endings will stimulate a particular response. That's helpful because it helps us to link the physical intimacies to emotional and spiritual realities. But thresholds can also indicate a boundary. So whenever we talk about moving to another stage in this 12 steps of pair bonding, Morris is indicating that we're stepping over another boundary, that you are permitting someone into a threshold, a deeper interior space in your own life, that when it's marked by trust, can open and develop in a beautiful kind of way. When it's violated, it can lead to pain and to destruction. So each step in this sequence of pair bonding will represent an additional kind of threshold. So let's roll. Desmond Morris says that stage one is eye to body. That all of us, Morris believes, have a sort of grading process whereby we evaluate other people. Somebody comes into your visual space, and you begin almost inevitably to go through an evaluative process of whether or not this is a potential candidate for intimacy. So we look at size, at sex, at shape, at age, at coloring, at status, at mood. And what we find is that a lot of people, when a relationship starts, will have a digital photo, a snapshot that registers upon their brain. So you can talk to many couples. I ask this oftentimes in premarital counseling. Is there a sudden snapshot that you have, or the first time that you met, or the first time that you suddenly said, aha, that particular person could be a potential dating candidate? So when I remember 30-some-odd years ago, my wife giving a testimony at our campus ministry, and I can see what she was wearing. I can remember the tone that she set and the reverence that was there that attracted me to her. I asked her, do you have any visual memory of me? And she said, oh, yeah. She said, you were trying to lead worship, and you were singing that song, swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me. And it got to the second verse that says, there's a band of angels coming after me. And you gave the hand motions, there's a band of angels coming after me. She married for pity. Somebody help that poor boy. But many couples will say that, even heard Dennis Kinlaw say, that he could remember the day in which his wife turned the corner at the CPO over here. And he suddenly said, I like what I see. And it became a remarkable kind of marriage. Now, one of the difficulties is that in our culture, whenever pornography has been at play, it sexualizes that look. The intent was that you would evaluate somebody in the wholeness of who they are. But if pornography is set in, it oftentimes fragments the person, and that look becomes single, focused on a particular body type or particular fragmentations of a person. Just one of the potential dangers of pornography. But what Morris is suggesting here is that in this first stage, there's not a lot of trust. It's mostly unilateral, but a threshold has been passed because now you're beginning to say, I'll give consideration to this other person as somebody that I might like to pursue in a relationship. Stage two, eye to eye. While we view others, they view us. You've oftentimes heard it said that her eyes were two thieves that stole my heart. In eye to eye, what's happening is another threshold is passed in which now there's mutuality. James Fowler was keen on saying that we all look for the eyes that recognize and the face that blesses. That something happens when there's reciprocity in a relationship. I saw you looking at me, and there's now something that we're looking for mutual interest. Mutual interest then crosses another threshold, the threshold of mutuality. Oftentimes, if we don't want that look, then when somebody's looking at us, it feels like an invasion of our privacy, and we quickly turn away. But when there's a reciprocity of interaction, it begins to set up this bonding sequence. Now, Morris, I don't think, could have anticipated the digital revolution. But it's interesting to think about. I had a student one time who came and said, I'm approaching 30. God hasn't brought Mr. Right into my life yet. And so I'm thinking about getting on a dating service. Wonder what you think about that. Not something I was prepared to answer that time as a professor. But here are some of the things I think are interesting. If Morris is right, that we use these eye-visual kind of cues in typical kinds of relationships, then if a relationship starts online, what's lost? Right? Perhaps technology is increasing our capacity for reading all of these cues, but most of the time it starts with the exchange of an email. So what happens is, interestingly enough, what I found out and said to her later, is that a couple of things you may need to know. Is that on dating services, about 80% of the people, by one study, said that they misrepresented some aspect of who they are. So what's happening is you're losing the filter that's oftentimes there in a family or a community to begin this relationship. Although there are those who say, on the other hand, maybe it's not so much that those things are gone, it's that you overcompensate for them by reading the words and paying even closer attention to what's happening in the exchange. That you parse the words, that you think about how much time has elapsed before somebody sent back a response. So there may be ways that that healthy bonding can happen even in the digital kind of context that we live in today. Stage three, voice to voice. Vocal contact. Now vocal contact is given into the kind of registry of thinking and evaluating the other person along with the visual cues. So what does a person sound like? The tone of voice, the dialect, the accent, the use of vocabulary. Is there a threshold that's being passed? Well, it's oftentimes in conversation where we determine whether we move from public space to personal space. You sit in a doctor's room and you begin to have a conversation and you look for common ground and you decide, do we move to that kind of deeper place? So the physical threshold being passed signals also the movement toward a deeper emotional threshold. Will I disclose something that has more emotional content? Will I say something about the opinions that I have? Will there be something about the habits or the emotional kind of places in which I live? So this new threshold ensues that a verbal exchange begins to disclose personal kinds of information. Historically, this vocal contact oftentimes signaled when a relationship starts. Again, I think it's interesting to ask, if you start a relationship online, when does that relationship actually start? Does it happen at the point at which you exchange emails, or does it happen at the point at which you actually have voice-to-voice, face-to-face kind of contact? Well, stage four, hand-to-hand. Morris notes that these early stages can all happen instantaneously, or they can happen over a period of time. You walk on campus, you see someone, you recognize, you look to them, they recognize you, you give a voice, a greeting, and you shake hands or give a hug, and you suddenly pass through four stages quickly of pair bonding. Or he says that these can happen in a much longer, prolonged kind of period of time. That if one is particularly shy in a relationship, then that initial touch becomes an interesting kind of gesture, right? Or Morris even says that there's a slip that oftentimes happens in which the other partner kind of catches you because you've slipped on the ice. And he says that both of you actually know exactly what's happening, that it's creating a possible sequence for the future, but it can be passed off as simply a slip if it's not reciprocated, and then you can end the relationship and move away pretty quickly. Same thing happens online, right? We kind of test these relationships, and before we get too emotionally involved, there's a place at which we can both dismiss it. But when it becomes more prolonged behavior, I watch this with my youngest son, is that when they started holding hands and making a physical representation, so beginning to present themselves as a couple, it was a significant change in the relationship. That now we were saying that that we are wanting, right? What's the equivalent of this on Facebook? Your status, right? In a relationship. And what are you communicating when you say in a relationship? You're off the market, right? You are now in a mutually exclusive relationship, and you're beginning to indicate, again, another threshold is being passed, that you're essentially saying that now we are moving to a space where this is not to be shared with anyone else. That's the physical gesture that Desmond Morris is noting. The emotional and spiritual gesture are that at that point, there are probably some places at which there are now, there are some things that are being shared in the relationship that are not meant for anybody else to be shared with. If that's not happening, then you begin to wonder, is trust really being built in a healthy, foundational way in this relationship? Stage five, arm to shoulder. Here, if you watched us praying, there was a sense in which we prayed together. This is the huddling together. Arm to shoulder is this public conveying. It's a conveyance of close friendship or shared purpose and ownership. You even see football teams sometimes that huddle together or that even hold hands in the huddle that are essentially saying we're about the same kinds of things. We belong to each other in the same way that a relationship needs that sense of bonding and of connection. Arm to waist, stage six, moves us to the place at which now this close intimacy becomes a deepening trust, a deepening statement. What's the threshold that's being passed here? Well, think about it. When men are together, it's okay to huddle. But you rarely find men that stand with their arms around somebody else's waist, right? What you're gesturing in this relationship is that you're moving from friendship to a sense of love. And you're pulling somebody closer to you. So it becomes important, I think, in the corollary, the parallel for the emotional and the spiritual, is that now you're beginning to say, this is somebody that I'm pulling close, that I'm ready to disclose my history to, that I might share things in this relationship that are meant only for the ears of this other person, and that this trust is being built in such a way that I feel more comfortable with that level of disclosure. This is the point at which it probably becomes time for a slow cultivation of the relationship. You're sitting side by side, you're side by side, but here it becomes important, I think, that the emotional and the spiritual match what's happening in the physical relationship. This is the point at which, probably the point at which the relationship is moving more serious. So this is the point at which it becomes important to have a lot of conversations about, this is what I project myself being in the future. These are the kind of vocational and family dreams that I have. And are you a person that is compatible and that's willing to support those dreams? If that shut down, if the relationship has become reliant solely upon a physical relationship, there's a tendency to become reliant upon that physical relationship and to skip these important steps of moving in kind of a deliberative process. In fact, one of the things that happens oftentimes in cohabitation is that couples begin to share things together, you begin to stay at each other's house. Somebody takes a nap on the couch, you bring some music over, and you leave your iPod there, and the relationship inertia moves you toward full intimacy without having these deliberate conversations. When there haven't been deliberate conversations that lead to commitment, it's pretty easy when the challenge and the danger and the angst and frustration comes in a relationship for somebody pretty easily to say, I never committed to you anyway. I'm out of here. And so these deliberate processes of conversation become important kinds of ways of measuring, engaging, and moving forward in a relationship. See if we can get to the next stages. Stage 7, face-to-face or mouth-to-mouth, the couple turns toward each other. More than a peck on the cheek, there's an acknowledgement that now there is whatever hesitancy there might have been in earlier stages. Now there's this movement, and face-to-face or mouth-to-mouth almost inevitably begins to trigger physiological arousal. In the same place, then, the relationship itself is moving toward full intimacy. So I become an advocate for long courtship and short engagements. Long courtships and short engagements. Group dating and being with each other in public spaces is an important way to test the viability of a relationship. Go together in many different places and see how you respond when you babysit kids together, when you visit the nursing home, when you share in ministry together to judge the compatibility of those relationships. This is the place at which, as the couple moves face to face, now there's more and more full disclosure of who one is. The presence or absence, I think, of this stage of that full disclosure is probably psychologically and spiritually telling. If someone is still hiding things at this particular place in a relationship, it probably should signal a red flag in the relationship. Stage 8 was a surprising one for me. Desmond Moore says that hand-to-head becomes the next stage in the physiological development of a relationship. We are routinely protective of who touches our head, as it represents one of the most protective parts of the body. If you allow your hair to be stroked, if the lines on your face are caressed or touched, it represents this kind of place of adoration, admiration, the studying of the body. I heard James Dobson's mother, I believe it was, say that when her husband died, she asked for 30 minutes to simply be with the body that she had known physically and intimately all through her life, and wanted the time to say goodbye to the body that she had come to adore. This is the place metaphorically where the warrior sets aside his psychological and physical armor and allows another person into the place where their life is literally put in another person's hands. It doesn't take too much imagination to think of Samson putting his head in the lap of Delilah as she strokes and begins to ask him, what is the strength of your life? And where he surrenders it, giving up the secrets of where his strength comes from. Stage 9, hand to body. The hand now begins to explore the partner's body. It commonly culminates with the male manipulating female's breasts. Morse notes that for many females, this reaches a threshold that oftentimes emits a temporary halt. It's as if the female body recognizes that it's difficult to put any kind of stop beyond this particular point. That almost inevitably, for satisfaction to occur, the relationship needs to move to full orgasmic kind of experience. The inner sanctum. Now, what is it that a woman needs to know? What is it that a man needs to know at that particular point? I think it's the place at which there's trust enough that I know that if I'm going to allow somebody past that threshold into the inner sanctum of my life, are you going to be there for me? Is this a forever love, or am I simply being used for somebody else's pleasure? Stage 10, mouth to breast. Morris here sees a movement to strict privacy. Although this may be a part of the previous step, here, especially in Western culture, the exposure of the female breast is oftentimes only done in private. It's at a lover's breast that a person revisits that dependency of being a baby again in the mother's arms. This transference, perhaps, that one is moving from one's mother to now the beloved. It's a gesture that marks that particular bond. Now, here we should add this point, too. That what neuroscience has said to us is that when there's central kinds of things that are happening, like stage 9 or 10, that dopamine is released in the brain. There's an increased level of dopamine and a decreased level of serotonin. Both of those hormones are positively associated with the firing of sexual desire. And both of them are called attachment hormones. That is, that when you engage in physical activity at stage 9 or stage 10, your body is releasing hormones that are intended to create an attachment effect with the person that you're experiencing this with. So when people intend a casual sexual encounter with no commitment, they oftentimes find themselves entangled in a relationship that actually has communicated something differently. What's important, again, about the bonding sequence is that if you are relying upon the physiological relationship, you can easily convince yourself that this is a soulmate for me. It's the way it's supposed to happen. God created us in such a way that the physiological response will naturally connect you to that other person. If you haven't gone through these early stages, it's likely that you're setting up a defective pair bond because you're judging the relationship simply upon physiological responses rather than upon this whole evaluation of whether trust is actually happening in a helpful and formational way. So legions are those for whom this unintentional emotional entanglement oftentimes happens if these steps of pair bonding have not been honored and gone through. Stage 11, hand to genital. The hand explores the partner's body and inevitably reaches the genital region. Morris describes this as gentle correcting and then stimulating the rhythm of intercourse. Here the intent is clearly for the relationship to move forward, although numerous couples now will justify sexual kind of experiences while still claiming technical virginity. But as a relationship moves on, this is the stage at which you especially need the protection of a marital relationship. Stage 12, we move to genital, the final consummation of this one flesh union. Here the threshold for Morris is that there is an irreversible act that happens with genital to genital contact. The hymen is ruptured, and with it the possibility of a second irreversible act, that of pregnancy. Now, what Morris has predicted is that when the 12-step process has been navigated properly, each stage brings a couple together bodily, emotionally, and spiritually. When each intimate threshold has been crossed and trust has been deepened in the crossing of that relationship, it opens couples to a full experience of becoming one that safeguards not only that relationship, but future relationships of children and the family in the future. That is to say that Craig Dykstra asked the question, or poses the question, of how is it that families are established? And he said that isn't it true that in many ways the establishment of a family begins with the making of promises? And he'll justify this in many different ways, the implicit promises that are made between a husband and a wife, but also between parents and children. Biblically, we can say that the making of promises was so important because it signals the covenant that God makes with us. That in the process, all of Israel, in many ways, are established upon the promise-making that God creates. But promises are given their significance based upon the context that gives them meaning. If I simply say to you, I'll be there for you, and it's a flippant context, it doesn't carry very much meaning. If it's surrounded in a context in which I'm saying, yes, I'll be there for you, I'm making a covenant pledge to you, it carries much more meaning. So the significance of the marriage covenant in the Christian tradition are that you take a vow before God, before the people of God, that's clear to you, clear to your partner, and clear to the community that you're a part of, that you're making it a promise that this is a love that's for keeps. It's that that builds the protection and the trust around a relationship that becomes so vital. C.S. Lewis said that when people are naturally in love, they naturally make promises to each other. So again, if someone's not willing to make those kind of promises, what is it signaling about the rest of the relationship? Well, let me suggest then that what Morris has laid out here may be a map for one flesh union. And what it provides for us, I think, is a gauge to say, so how far is too far in a relationship? Are there places at which the emotional and the spiritual are matching what's happening with the physical relationship? Where it is, I think we can say that a couple is moving closer and closer to the creation intent of one flesh union. And where it's not, trust is probably being broken, and we're probably setting ourselves up for the inner loneliness, the sickness that was so common of what Morris was trying to help us avoid. So my prayer, my hope for you is that this provides us some opportunities for conversation. Not only in a community in which we can say what looks like healthy courtship, healthy dating, and healthy one flesh union, but also some questions for couples to ask each other. Have we progressed too far? Are there places at which we may need to move back to these early steps and do the work of healthy pair bonding before we progress onward in the relationship? When I learned this, I had had previous relationships that ended in heartbreak. And what we know statistically is that 90 to 95% of people will report that they've been in relationships that ended in a heartbreaking experience. And about 70% of young adults will say to us that their first sexual encounter was way before they were mature enough for that encounter to have occurred. I think what the 12 steps give us is a place of saying that how mature does one need to be before they're ready to let somebody cross into the thresholds of their lives and to open up this particular effect. Beyond about stage 9, it's pretty difficult to end a relationship without having the same divorce effect that oftentimes happen when there's a ripping of a relationship between two different people. But on the other hand, when these steps are followed well, each of them take on symbolic significance. So that oftentimes what happens is that when a relationship has simply been relied upon the physical relationship itself, if you become relying upon that, where you'll end is in a place of saying what we want to use to cement this relationship is the focus will be increasingly upon the frequency and the intensity of the orgasmic experience. Isn't it interesting to see culture today that is creating so many pharmacological kind of remedies to say let's increase the potency and the vibrancy of the sexual climactic experience? What Morris, I think, would say as a contrary is that if you follow these stages of pair bonding, that each one will take on significance, and that the way that real one flesh union happens is that the sexual act becomes endowed with the beauty of a symbolic gesture that everywhere conveys the meaning of trust and beauty. I watched my 80-year-old grandparents this week as dad is now oftentimes on a walker, walking up the steps and hobbling as he got to climbing the stairs. And my 83-year-old mother reaching over and grabbing him to stabilize him and moving up the steps. And I thought there are places at which our culture probably wouldn't understand the depth of what 60 years of marriage have now procured for them, because even that small gesture conveys the whole history of their relationship, of a relationship that was built in trust and beauty and these 12-step pairs that moved to this one flesh union. So I want to pray for you as young adults, that as you enter these kinds of relationships, that you can find a roadmap, that your deep yearnings for intimacy can become ways that you recognize that these are God's call and His imprint upon your life to become representations of His Trinitarian love as you enter into these beautiful relationships. Let me pray for us. Oh God, we thank you that you have created us as sexual beings. And we thank you that there are those guides that can lead us in places to this one flesh union. And so I pray for these young people that they could lay hold of the grand vision that you have of the beauty of intimacy in a one flesh union. And I pray for those, Lord, who may have felt like they moved out of the economy of that, that you would help them to know that that there is always grace that's made available to them, and that there's always the opportunity of moving back to a one flesh, vulnerable, naked, and unashamed relationship that you've intended. Bless our reflections and our ruminations today as we move closer to your ideal. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.